Welcome to today's SLA podcast on social injustice with your host, Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sport Institute, and our guest, Kevin Warren, Commissioner of the Big Ten Conference. Professor Shropshire is CEO of the Global Sport Institute and the Adidas Distinguished Professor of Global Sport at Arizona State University. He recently closed out a 30-year career as an endowed full professor at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania, where he was also director of the Wharton Sports Business Initiative, professor of Africana Studies, and academic director of Wharton's sports-focused executive education programs. He now holds the title of Wharton Professor Emeritus. As an author, his books include Sports Matters, Leadership, Power, and the Quest for Respect in Sports, Negotiate Like the Pros, A Top Sports Negotiator's Lessons for Making Deals, Building Relationships, and Getting What You Want, and Being Sugar Ray, The Life of America's Greatest Boxer and First Celebrity Athlete. Additional works include the foundational books In Black and White, Race and Sports in America, The Business of Sports, and The Business of Sports Agents. His 12th book is The Miseducation of the Student Athlete, How to Fix College Sports, which was published last year. He graduated from Stanford in 1977 with a degree in economics and Columbia Law School in 1980. Before beginning his career in the academy, he practiced law in Los Angeles and was an executive with the Los Angeles Olympic Organizing Committee. He serves as a consultant to numerous sports entities. Today's guest, Kevin Warren, officially became the sixth commissioner of the Big Ten Conference on January 2, 2020, and the first African-American commissioner to lead an Autonomy 5 conference. Prior to that, Warren served as the chief operating officer for the Minnesota Vikings of the National Football League, where he worked since 2005. He was the highest-ranking African-American executive working on the business side for a team in the NFL and was the first African-American COO in NFL history. After being promoted to COO, Warren played a critical role in all business, financial, legal, and operational aspects related to U.S. Bank Stadium and was involved in the design, construction, business, legal, and operational components of the new stadium. Under Warren's visionary leadership, the Vikings restructured the organization with an emphasis on broadening the executive team and promoting women to key executive positions. A former basketball player at both the University of Pennsylvania and Grand Canyon University in Phoenix, several members of Warren's family have helped fuel his lifelong passion for academics and sports, including his father, the late Dr. Morrison Warren Sr., who had a successful career at Arizona State University as a professor of education and who played professional football for the Brooklyn Dodgers. Warren's mother served the community as an elementary school librarian. His oldest brother, Morrison Jr., was one of the first African-American scholarship athletes at Stanford, playing football for the Cardinals in the early 1960s. Please enjoy this inspirational discussion on social injustice, and stay tuned for an SLA announcement on a follow-up virtual outreach event where today's presenters will be available to discuss this topic with you.
Kevin, great for you to join us on this. Sports Lawyer Association has been doing a lot of conversations, but this is one I've really been looking forward to. How are things going for you?
Ken, always good to hear your voice. I appreciate your support and encouragement over the years. So things are going well. Needless to say, it's been an interesting first year. I just had my year anniversary on September 16th at the Big Ten when I started, but formally become a commissioner on January 2nd. So kind of in my 10th month, so a lot has happened.
Well, good. Hope you're getting those paychecks from the beginning. I don't want two jobs at once, at least.
Right.
But Kevin, and for our listeners, some of you may want to tune out now because we're not going to zero in on a lot of the current issues with the Big Ten, but we really want to talk is really two African American men that have been involved in social justice issues throughout our lives, and to get some of Kevin's viewpoints on a lot of these issues and how he's involved, and really for those thinking about or who are sports business leaders or future leaders, especially if you're a person of color, how do you continue to stay engaged but still be in the mainstream in terms of a business enterprise? So that's really a lot of, Kevin, of where, mm-hmm. where I want to take people. I think that's something that needs to be talked about, and I think a lot of people haven't heard enough about. You know, just to start off, why don't you just talk about your professional journey? I've seen it written up a lot in a lot of different places, but I still don't think everybody really knows where you came from and how you got there. So why don't you just take a few minutes and walk us through that and how you ended up in that big chair you sit in now.
Yeah, sure. I mean, fortunately, I grew up in a household of individuals who focused on academics. My father was a football student athlete in the mid 40s at Arizona State University, was named one of their 50 greatest players of all time, fought in the war, came back and finished his degree at Arizona State, got his master's and doctorate. And it took him a while. I mean, my dad never blamed anyone. He just kind of dealt with it. I think that's probably where I get a lot of that in my spirit from, is just to don't blame, don't complain, you know, recognize that on certain times and certain points of your career, the race will play a part in it. And right. And so my father, took him longer than it should have to become a professor at Arizona State. And he was a high school principal for a while. He was an elementary school principal. You can imagine that, although that's an honorable job, but having a doctorate degree and just couldn't get an opportunity at Arizona State. Then eventually got his chance to become a professor at ASU. But he was incredibly instrumental in race relations at Arizona State. I mean, Arizona State was scheduled to play, at the time it was called Texas Western, which is now University of Texas, El Paso. And Texas Western called Arizona State and said, don't bring your two black players because we can't guarantee their safety. Ironically, one of the black players was my dad. The other one was my uncle. And so my dad approached the president of Arizona State at the time and said, it's a shame that we're even going to play this game. And ASU stood up and then canceled the game and said, if we can't bring our two black players and we're not interested in coming. And that really was a key, you know, step in many of the rules and regulations in Texas, especially at Texas Western University, of changing how they approached it. And ironically, you fast forward, Texas El Paso was the first school to star five black players when they won a national championship against University of Kentucky, as Adolph Rupp as the coach. But so growing up in the household, my dad stressed academics. My mother was absolutely brilliant. She didn't finish her college degree until 41. She had me at 40, then went back to school and finished her degree, went on and got her master's degree, and was actually an elementary school librarian. But she loved books. She loved to read. She loved to dream. Was an absolutely beautiful woman, but you could tell, if you ever look really deep in her eyes, that she had a lot of pain. Her mother was from Guadalajara, Jalisco, Mexico, and who was a maid in Phoenix for many years, only finished second grade. And her father was a soldier at Fort Huachuca. And when my mom came home in eighth grade one time, my dad left, and she never saw him again. And so she was always kind of in search of kind of the completeness in her life. But two great parents, school was important. Oldest brother was one of the first scholarship student athletes at Stanford. And so I'm the youngest of seven kids. So by the time I came along, the concrete was already formed that academics was first, academics was second, academics was third, academics was fourth, and sports was fifth. And so my mom made it very clear, if you don't get your schoolwork done, if you're disrespectful to a referee, if you're disrespectful to a teammate or disrespectful to a coach, that you weren't going to be able to participate in. So that's how I started, lived in South. Yeah.
Uh-huh. I'll tell you, I mean, as you know, and Kevin and I have known each other for a while. I recently, past 3 years, moved down here to the Phoenix area. And one of the first things I did was try to find a church here, and ended up going to a church called South Minister Presbyterian.
Yeah, that's where I grew up. I was baptized there.
I didn't realize that until after the fact. And it's a very small church. So I was talking to people. Meet this person named Warren and these people, mm-hmm. other people, and people were telling me about the neighborhood that Elijah Muhammad used to spend time there. So you really, really do come from a place. I mean, when people hear you from Arizona, I don't think most people understand the rich history that Arizona has as a place there's a deep history of African American struggle. I mean, you know, some of the stories that you didn't talk about were the role that your uncles played in integrating the high schools locally, yep. sport yep. locally at that kind of level. So it's something that's been there with you from the beginning.
It really has. And when you start, you make me smile talking about Southminster. I mean, I was born, raised, baptized there, went to, you know, preschool, you know, there. And it was literally, that's on basically, you know, probably around 27th and Broadway. I was actually born and raised on 2131 East Violet Drive. So we could actually walk there. And our house, ironically, was directly across the street from the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, that the house that he lived in. And I just watched during this pandemic, I've watched more documentaries than I have literally in my life.
We all have.
Yeah, and I watched the one Who Killed Malcolm X. And in there, they actually have a letter that they put up on the screen that Malcolm X wrote to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And it was the address on Violet Drive that was directly across the street from where we grew up. So we really did have rich history growing up in that neighborhood.
My goodness. So talk about your athletic career. I think that's inspirational in some ways.
So I grew up in Phoenix. And again, what I always tell my kids, don't think that how we live now is how I grew up. It's just the opposite. And every time that I'm in Phoenix, I always try to make the time to run by my old neighborhood just to stay grounded, to remember, you know, where we came from, a 1,300 square foot house that cost $13,000 that my parents raised seven kids in. And our neighborhood started to get rough. And I remember even, you know, as a kid, I would see Elijah Muhammad walking up and down the street. And my mom reminded me when I got older that I made a comment one time, boy, they walk a lot. And she's, you know, my mom was a very, as I said, straight shooter, practical person. She said, no, they don't do that for their health. They do it because their house is being bugged by the FBI. And so they would have all their meetings up and down the street. And I know it was a big story when Cassius Clay came into the neighborhood. When I was about in fifth grade, we ended up, our neighborhood started to get really rough. So we actually moved to Tempe, Arizona. My dad was a professor at Arizona State at the time, moved in Tempe. And that second summer that I was there and was going up to the park, the local high school, to play sports, and the lady lost control of her car and ran up on the sidewalk and hit me. And I say, by the grace of God, I was fortunate to live. I ended up breaking my femur and wrist and so many other injuries, and so spent many, many months in traction in the hospital, and also many, many months in a body cast. And so I think the reality of that time spent really on my back. And so I tell people, if you really want to try to live, is to spend time flat on your back, trying to, you know, eat all of your meals and go to the bathroom. And so when I got out of the body cast, the doctor didn't give me much of a chance to participate in high level competition. I took some of the settlement money, convinced my parents for me to use it, and built a swimming pool in our backyard. So I actually have written a book about it called Build Your Own Pool, mm-hmm. and which will be coming out next year. But worked hard and almost, you know, at that time I was 10 and a half years old, so 7 years from the time of my accident, I was able to play Division I basketball at the University of Pennsylvania. I spent a couple years there, came home to Arizona State just for a minute, and ended up at Grand Canyon University, which is in North Phoenix. And that's really where my life changed. We had always gone to church, gone to Southminster. I knew how to pray. But that's when I truly learned how to understand the power of the Bible, how to read the Bible. The importance of tithing and trying to just do the, you know, walk with God. And so was fortunate to stay healthy, had a great career there, and was really emotional in 2012 when I got the call about going in there, Sports Hall of Fame. So sports has always been important to me. I tell people it saved my life because it was me focusing on going to play Division I basketball is really what helped me heal and get over my accident, not only physically, but also mentally.
And Kevin, I always find that story striking when you tell me. I mean, again, I knew you for years before I knew that that accident was even a part of your life. I mean, which is I think something else for young people that repetition of stories that may be negative or may be in some ways a deep part of your life. Everybody want to hear it all the time, and you certainly carry that story appropriately and deliver it when asked, but it's not a big piece. And I'm glad the book's coming out too. I think that will give people a lot of perspective on where you came from. You know, you mentioned your brother who went to Stanford and who I have a special admiration for. I mean, I went to Stanford as well some years later, and we had spent time looking for the first black athletes at Stanford. There was a guy, Ed Tucker, that played basketball, and your brother, the first one to come in and play football. Did he, or a lot of discussion, did he come home and talk about it? Was there a lot of discussion in the moment of what you went through?
It was interesting because Morrison was actually, he's 20 years older than me. So I was born when he was a junior at Stanford. So my parents, I mean, that's what I mean. You're talking about, he and I are the bookends. I mean, he's one of my heroes. I look up to him. I mean, this is a guy who was one of the early black student athletes, football student athletes, to go from Phoenix to Palo Alto. Parents didn't have the resources, so he actually took a Greyhound bus from Phoenix to Palo Alto, which is not a, that's not a short trip. But to go there and was doing incredibly well athletically, he's, you know, brilliant person academically, but then ended up tearing his ACL, and couldn't play anymore. Most people who would have gone through that, and he is one of those ones you never say can't miss, but if he had not been hurt, I mean, he was all state in basketball, football, and baseball, probably was a better baseball player than he was than football, but he would have been a professional, you know, athlete. He was smart, but couldn't play, but most people would have left, and he stayed. So he ended up getting an economics degree from Stanford in 4 years, you know, after his injury ended his career. And so when you see that kind of moxie, and then went on, and then with the Stanford degree, went and volunteered for Vietnam. He wasn't drafted, and he ended up volunteering for Vietnam and fought it in the war. By the time of my memories that I can remember as a kid, hearing those stories of, you know, I think about the Greyhound bus to Palo Alto, then an injury and working through all those issues, and then going to Vietnam and come back, you know, that has really been an inspiration. So he tells great stories. Stanford did an incredible article last year on him and his journey there, and then him being in a fraternity, quite naturally was a white fraternity, but how he's developed lifelong friends. And I actually, growing up, I wanted to go to Stanford because he talked so fondly of it. And when you hear people talk so fondly of an institution, it drew me near there. And then it was crazy as I got older and I would ask him questions on it. Then that's when I found out about his injury. You know, then I found out, you know, a lot of the issues that he had to deal with. But because of Stanford being Stanford, it was really powerful. And he spent so much time with me. I remember, and that's why I'm so conscientious right now of things that I say to people and time that I spend with people to make it qualitative, because I can think about back over my life's. Some things that I remember about my brother Morrison, he probably doesn't even remember how important it was. And I remember Stanford played a University of Arizona when I was in maybe early high school. And my father and Morrison drove down to Tucson for the game. And I went, and I remember going down to the game, but just being there. So this is a person that you would have thought he ended up having a brilliant career and was all American, but to get in the car to drive down to Tucson to go see Stanford play for a person who was injured, he was just really so proud of the experiences that he had at Stanford University.
That's so interesting. And it really, I can only imagine, you know, I was there maybe a dozen years after him, but I can only imagine. And we had about 9 or 10 African-American players on the team. I can only imagine being in the setting that he, and, you know, I think of him as on the tail end of that greatest generation that did so much of that, being, you know, being the first people, you know, reference you as the first African-American commissioner of a major conference. But it's rare that we have these first left like that. But he was in that whole wave of all these major firsts that were taking place. So Kevin, kind of to move forward a little bit, I'm trying to capsulize the time and think about activism. You know, I think you were a little bit younger than me, so we're in school a little bit after me. But I tell people that you know, we got a chance to look at the 60s and kind of the beginning of the 70s or so. But the moment that so many of us were in, there wasn't the same kind of activism, I'd say, opportunities as there were Vietnam War, civil rights movement. And even when people criticize, you know, you go into the 90s when they criticize Michael Jordan, I say, well, you know what, in that moment, there weren't necessarily as publicly the kinds of issues striking him directly as you saw in the 60s, early 70s, and then today. I don't know what your take is on it. I mean, some of this is you know, my son was playing tennis at Northwestern when people started kneeling. We had a long talk about kneeling. So some of this may be defensive on my part, but I don't know. What do you think about the time when you're at Penn and at GCU? And I don't know, maybe you were involved in some activism, maybe not. But what was the setting when you were that student athlete?
You know, but it wasn't much activism, I would say, during my time period. But, you know, my parents, especially my dad, always did stress, you know, to me to recognize that every time, you know, you go out on the court, even in practice or in games, travel, you know, that you have a chance to reset the deck for how people not only view you. And he would always say, it's not about you. It's really about us and how people view you. So that's why I've been really conscientious of making sure that even if it's just one person, if you can change the mindset or the life of just one person, how they view people of color. And then, so that's one of the reasons why I take this current job that I have so seriously, and have taken all of them so seriously, because when I think of a conference like the Big Ten that has been in existence for over 125 years, and to have only 5 commissioners, I mean, even, and I'm in my office now, I have the 5 commissioners. That's the first thing that I see when I open the door, just as a reminder, you know, with, you know, John Griffith and you know where it started there, and just to go through the lineage of the unbelievable leaders that they've had here, but recognize that they all look very similar, and none of them look like me, and so from John Griffith all the way to Jim Delaney, that I have to keep in mind that every single day that I come into this office, I've not only been blessed with the opportunity to be commissioner of the Big Ten, but that many people will, you know, view what I do or what I don't do maybe through a different lens because of the color of my skin. That's something I can't change, don't want to change. But what I can do is to make sure that I continually stay true to my values, don't take things personal, work incredibly hard, you know, keep doing the things that got me here, and recognize that I'm building a legacy that hopefully others who come behind me and who look like me, whether it's in this conference or other conferences, that they would be given an opportunity, you know, based upon the content of their character and work ethic and not only the color of their skin.
And that's part of, Kevin, that's part of the complexity that I wanted to get to. I mean, I think about, you know, different venue, same sort of thing, that, you know, high ranking person at Arizona State. I was lone African-American professor sometimes at the Wharton School. And, you know, if as my mother would say, if I acted out, I would no longer have, in some settings, the credibility that I needed to have to do the things that I could do inside of those rooms. Not to say I wanted to act out or not. Not to say, as you do, I didn't speak out when need be. But it's a different kind of positioning from someone. You know, part of the battle is to get in the room. Part of the battle is to get in the room. Once we're in the room, I think there's a different approach that needs to be taken. I mean, is that fair, Fraser?
Yeah, I'd say that's fair. Absolutely fair. We have to recognize that you know, right, wrong, or indifferent is that the we have to do the absolute best that we possibly can do, and just recognize that the path is probably not going to be smooth. You know, these are unique opportunities, and I knew even this first year coming into it, I didn't know that we'd be dealing with COVID-19, but I knew coming in this year, I just knew it in my spirit. Sure. That it would be a complex and complicated year for various reasons, and recognizing, you know, recognizing that. But again, you know, you get one life to live. I've always embraced challenges. I've always, you know, been very comfortable in my own skin, and to be able to go against the kind of the grain and continually do, you know, what I believe is right, you know, in the best interest of the people that we serve, and you know, we serve every morning. I wake up, and when I roll out of the bed and get on my knees and my face to say my daily, you know, prayers, I think about the 10,000 student athletes and the many coaches and athletic directors and administrators and 6 million alumni and our chancellors and presidents of these 14 incredible institutions that span across 11 states. So, it's not something to be afraid of. It's something that I know I've embraced. And on a daily basis, and I look back over this year, and although there have been times that it's been very demanding, and but I don't take those things personally. I don't pay attention to media reports or what people say or think. I just know that there's a path that for us to continually be the Big Ten that we need to follow, and sometime it won't be in making the most popular or the easy decisions. So I'm honored every day to be able to serve here as commissioner of the Big Ten Conference. It's been a great experience. I've learned a lot about, you know, people and situations and circumstances and the importance of alignment. And I look forward to just having, just getting our football season kicked off in the right manner next weekend and hopefully having a very healthy fall season of not only football, but hockey and also basketball.
And what are your views, Kevin, on student and professional athlete activism in the broadest sense? I don't know how much, personal view might differ from a leadership view, but give me your thoughts on athlete activism, especially for the young men and women of today.
I think the importance from where I sit and stand on a daily basis, I'm all for people in general, but especially, you know, athletes, being very focused on activism. But the biggest thing that I always remind myself of, and I remember a lot of conversations I would have with, you know, players in the NFL when I worked in the NFL was make sure that it's authentic and make sure that when the cameras aren't on or when the reporters aren't around, that it's something that you really believe in, that you do. And that's all I used to tell many of our athletes at the Vikings that, and I tell my son and daughter that just be authentic and understand it and understand the rationale. So if you promote voting or talk about inequality in voting or issues with voter suppression, you know, get registered to vote, you know, understand it, do your homework. So I'm a big believer in making sure stand up for your rights and whatever makes sense for you, then that's what you need to focus on. And so for some student athletes, you know, kneeling may not be what makes sense for them. And I tell other athletes, don't judge them for not kneeling. There is no really right and wrong when you're passionate about of what's in your heart, you know, to do. And so it has been interesting to see what's going on in the college landscape as far as what's going on our college campuses. One thing I'll say, and speaking for our Big Ten student athletes and other college athletes, is the fact that our young people are incredibly, incredibly bright. And I sometimes compare where I was during my college journey to the student athletes now and day. I mean, they're well read, they're well traveled, they're incredibly bright, they're articulate, and so those are the things that I look forward to. And I've said it, you know, many times before here. You know, our student athletes here, if you really are desirous to be president of the United States of America, you can do it. I mean, you know, people have shown us they can do it. And I want them to think about a career to be commissioner. And because these are the things I know, I don't know if you were differently, but I know for me growing up, I never could have told you who was the Ivy League commissioner. I didn't even know that was a job. But I now, because, you know, these are the things that I'm honored to represent this conference, that I hope our student athletes recognize whatever they want to do. If they want to coach, if they want to teach, if they want to be a lawyer, doctor, pastor, you know, priest, preacher, you know, school teacher, librarian, or commissioner, that they can do it. I mean, one good thing about what's happening in society now is that it really is wide open. And I think just having a strong faith in God, working hard, being diligent, and recognizing that overnight success probably takes somewhere between 15 and 20 years, and just stay on the grind, that really the sky's the limit for these young people.
No, I agree. My kids are a little bit older. You know, I've got one in law school now that played professional tennis for a while, and one that's getting an MBA at the Wharton School. And I do see a future for them that's very different from mine. And their aspirations are so different because I think, as you said, they're so much less self-limiting. They can see how bright things can be. And I think about these kids that have opportunity, especially African-American kids, white kids too, to grow up with the only president you knew was Barack Obama. I mean, to have that kind of imagery of possibility is something that's truly, truly unique.
Yeah.
You know, Kevin, I'm going to start to close out here, but I do want to talk a little bit about kind of the post George Floyd moment, mm-hmm. and the kind of conversations. You know, we haven't talked about this directly, but I'm sure you have engaged with people as I have. And I've been asking a lot of people to reflect on what they've had a chance to say in these kinds of moments. And I tell you the moment I'm talking about. I had so many of my white friends, old and new, ask me, post George Floyd, what should I do? What should I do? And these are people in positions of power, you know, team leaders or leaders of sports apparel companies, and they'll look me in the eye or in the Zoom in most cases. What is it that I should do? What kinds of answers do you give in that setting? We'll close out with this.
Yeah, Ken, I just want you to know how much I have looked up to you and how much you've inspired me. I mean, for you, what you have accomplished at Arizona State, but what you also accomplished at the University of Pennsylvania and at Wharton, but your ability to articulate clearly, to be passionate. You may be a professor and an educator, cool. and I just want, I say that sincerely. I mean, I really, really admire what you've done. And there are many a days that I thought about you and you know, the path that you had, you know, set forth. And regarding your answer, I'm a big one by one person, you know, that you can change the world, you know, one by one. And that's really where it is. I had many of my friends ask me the same thing. And I would tell them the same thing I tell people on diversity and inclusion and social justice and on implicit bias is to basically treat every person you meet, you know, as if they were a family member that you cared about. And a lot of that is just a mindset. You know, so many times you see people come into the workforce and you know, we may onboard them and treat them like an employee. But if your son or daughter was coming to work at the Big Ten, I would look out for them. But I need to do that for everyone that comes to work, you know, here. And that's what we have to do. We have to recognize that this world is going to be saved and also, you know, given a sense of empowerment by us starting to take care of each other. And we got to recognize whether people are straight, gay, or have purple hair, or, you know, gold teeth, or educated, or maybe lack of financial resources, or wealthy, or whatever, that we really are all the same. And that's one thing, you know, this whole journey with COVID there's been some rough parts of it, that we've had over 200,000 people, you know, pass. And I mean, here just in the United States, but the good thing about it, you know, so much positive gain and energy have come along with a lot of pain. People have lost their lives. And what happened, I was actually in the Twin Cities when George Floyd was murdered. I was there. And I recognize that the good thing about it, although this man lost his life and so many other people have, from, you know, Armand Arbery and Breonna Taylor and so many others. I was there last year living there and working at the Vikings when Philando Castile was murdered also, is that you recognize that we'll make their journey all the worth it is that if we make this world, you know, a better place. We just, our children, our next generations, multiple generations, they deserve better. And we have to start, you know, treating others with decorum, doing the things that we need to be doing. We live in such a great country with incredible resources. And it's time for us to get, you know, this right. But the thing that's most encouraging to me is that many things that you and I would talk about at dinner, and I remember some of the dinners that we've had at Super Bowls over the years, things that you and I would talk about on the phone, finally now, is that people are talking about these in groups of Black people and white people. And that's the thing about it, is that finally, a lot of the things we talk about in our churches and around our dinner tables with our close friends, people now are starting to talk about it. And I think what we need to do is just don't have a short memory, never forget what we went through. People lost their lives. All of these different, you know, issues, and this has been going on from the beginning of time, but Emmett Till all the way up till now. And so I think as individuals like you and I have a responsibility that we need to tell the stories. We need to talk about these issues. We need to take a stance. We need to be good to other people. We need to do right by people, but we need to hold ourselves and others accountable, to make sure that we leave this world, in a good, you know, position. Because I think back to our parents. I mean, they didn't have a lot of resources, but they worked hard to making sure that they provided us with opportunities. And I think we need to do the same. So I'm looking forward. It's been a painful 2020 on multiple levels, but I'm looking forward to 2021, that we can make some serious progress for people, white and Black people, coming together, and that we can look forward and make you know, do the things that we really should, you know, should be doing. I've said it all the time that I don't think there's ever a rainbow before a storm. I mean, and that's, a rainbow's only come after storms. And then 2020 has been a year full of storms, and I'm expecting 2021 to be a year full of rainbows, and looking forward to great things and even getting closer with you. So I appreciate the time today.
No, Kevin, I can't thank you enough. I mean, that, you know, one of the sayings we've been, you know, weather related sayings we've been telling each other down here is, it's, you know, it's not just a storm, it's a new climate, which can be a good thing. A new climate with a rainbow would be even better. So I can't thank you enough. Just, you know, to people that are listening to this, I mean, Kevin and I have known each other for a while, just as kind of two lawyers roaming around.
Yeah.
Trying to make things happen in life, and there's something to maintaining relationships. You never know who's going to be successful, who's not. You never know who needs a hand, who doesn't. But it is the people that make the difference in the level of success you can have. And as you know, the main focus of this conversation was about activism, and it is to have somebody else to talk to about the issues that are important and make decisions on which ways to move. The commissioner of the Big Ten, Kevin Warren. Thank you.
Yeah, Ken, thank you very much. God bless you and your family. I look forward to talking with you soon.
Likewise.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us for this SLA presentation. Check your inbox and our site, sportslaw.org, for information on the follow-up virtual outreach event, as well as for all other content that resides on our site.